Welcome to the Implicit Bias podcast series presented by the University of Minnesota Medical School Department of Orthopedic Surgery, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee in partnership with the Medical School Office of DEI.
Welcome to the Implicit Bias podcast. I'm Dr. Caitlin Chambers, an orthopedic surgeon in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Minnesota. I welcome listeners to a multi-episode series focused on implicit bias. Throughout this five-part series, we've been talking with our Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion staff about implicit bias, how our own biases impact search and selection committees, and drilling into key aspects like race and gender. Today, we're back with our friends from ODEI, Matt and Shania, to continue our implicit bias discussion on gender and coded language. Welcome, Matt and Shania. So today, would you guys begin by explaining to our listeners what gender bias is and how it shows up in the workplace, more specifically in search and selection committees?
Yeah, sure. Good to be here. Thank you. So maybe I'll just get us started just thinking about this whole idea of gender bias. So think about this in terms of unfair advantages or disadvantages based on gender. And likely they can be implicit biases, those biases that are internalized. But they can also be explicit as well based on maybe certain things that people say or choices that are made. So say like maybe one candidate selected versus another based on maybe some of those gender biases that we would hold. So a lot of this whole idea comes from like perceptions on gender roles that we tend to believe. I say we, not speaking just for myself, but just kind of in general, there's a lot of data and research that shows that there are many people that still have beliefs that, you know, women are more emotional or more focused on family, and men are brave and focused on career. There's data that shows that these mindsets can certainly creep into how we engage with others, and then maybe even how we select them, you know, for a particular job, which, as you can see, could be advantageous for some and disadvantageous for others. And obviously, we want to be as equitable as possible. Anything to add to that, Shania?
Yeah, definitely, Matt. You know, picking up from what you just said, I definitely want to focus in on how this is showing up in the search and selection committee. So right now, we know that there aren't many women in orthopedic surgery, and that is a gender gap that we wish to close so we can have better patient outcomes, right? But why is that? So when you may find yourself on a search and selection committee, knowing that there are more men being represented in this field, you may come up against two different types of biases. One being affinity, wanting to hire folks who are similar to yourselves, which may be other men, and also confirmation bias. So again, going back to your perceptions on gender roles, Matt, if we're only seeing men in an orthopedic surgeon role, then that's confirming that we should only hire men for that role. And so those are two ways that we may see it play out. And so whenever you're in a search and selection committee, definitely slowing down your thinking, working together as a committee to check your biases and just make sure that you're using objective data to measure each candidate appropriately.
I think that's super helpful to put a name on it, because affinity bias is something that I've certainly seen throughout my time in such a male-dominated field. I mean, we call it the old boys club, is kind of how you dumb that down. But it's, you know, a bunch of guys who get along with a bunch of guys, and sometimes throwing a gal into the mix can throw things off, or somebody who's different for any other reason. So I think that's super helpful to kind of hear about that as a true bias, and to think approaching that in our search and selection committee here at University of Minnesota. And in our orthopedic surgery residency search and selection, we've really had a big focus on avoiding words like fit, like they would fit in this program. So we're not looking for somebody who will fit. We're looking for somebody who will add value. So I think that's a super, I would agree with you guys, super important thing to emphasize. Now, when we think about how bias shows up in orthopedic surgery, gender disparity is certainly evident. We've touched on that a little bit already. gender bias favoring men and disfavoring women is reinforced through these organizational and educational gender gaps. So how can we best support and see women as valuable assets in our search and selection process?
Yeah, I can start us off with this one. So part of this work, you know, Shania mentioned, you know, slowing down is really important. When we can slow down our thinking and slow down the choices that we make, that is honestly really helpful. And there's research that shows us how important that is, just to pause and reflect on the choices you're making and the way in which you're thinking. And although it sounds very simplistic, it's actually a really big ask. And the reason I say that is because we live in a world where things move fast. And when we're in a search and selection committee, you know, there's a decision that has to be made. There's a role that has to be filled. Maybe there are a lot of candidates. Maybe there are a lot of interviews. Maybe I have my to-do list to get back to, or there's, you know, a lot of work to get done here. So let's just move quickly through it. And what happens with that is we use what Shanae and I often will talk about, this whole idea of mental shortcuts, this whole idea of, you know, I'm just going to make this quick decision and just move faster because it's just easier for me just to do that. And you know, well, I've seen this character before. I've seen this behavior before. Dr. Chambers, you mentioned, you know, the old boys club. Like, well, this person would fit in really well. You talk about that idea of fit. Yeah, we don't want fit. What we want is someone to meet the criteria of the role. And so we need to be conscious of the expectations of the role that we're hiring someone for and focus on objective information as much as possible, especially when we're making decisions. So having a rubric, having set criteria that we're using to make a decision and to hire someone is extremely important, just so that we can focus less on, you know, the way I feel about someone, or allow those biases to creep in and make some of those mental shortcuts and decisions for me, and make sure that, okay, this person fit the criteria that we have set forth, and that's what we want in this particular candidate.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. Just to add to that, you know, taking it a step further, when reviewing a CV of a candidate and the contributions that they are making to the field, right? Thinking about the research that they're focusing on. So for instance, you know, there are studies that show that our female identified patients are not getting the same level of care, right, as our male patients. And so hiring candidates that are going to advance our mission of diversity, equity, inclusion, and bringing in that scholarly expertise so that we can begin to close some of these patient-related gender gaps. So for instance, we know that there's a gender gap in orthopedic care, as studies have shown that women represent about 75% of patients that present with patellar instability. However, the patellar instability was largely ignored for decades, and it wasn't seen as a worthy surgical management focus area for some time. And so if we had candidates that were bringing light to issues like that, that is going to directly impact the patient outcomes that we're hoping to achieve, and making sure that we believe women when they say, hey, these are my symptoms, and not contributing it again to an emotional cause, and instead really paying attention to what they're saying as it relates to the physical symptoms, and then just believing them. And so the more women that we can recruit to the field to not only do research in the field, but also to better relate to our patients, it's going to be a win-win all the way around.
I think that's such a great point, that growing our department or our field focus on diversity, equity, inclusion is not simply about changing what the faces of our department looks like, but making sure we're bringing in people who also have that same interest. So I think that's a super great point to take a look at the research. You know, when I'm reviewing applications, I'm looking at the volunteer opportunities, the organizations they're involved in. So you can get an idea of things from there too. So look for people who really have that same interest in mind in terms of looking at these means of improving the diversity, equity, inclusion within our field. So thank you for that.
Totally. And if I could just ask somebody real quick too, you know, just to kind of underscore all this, is there's so much more we can do for each other and for ourselves and for our community when we have diversity of thought, right? The more similar we are in nature, the fewer advancements we can really make. You know, when we can share different ideas and bring in different perspectives, you know, whether that is based on gender or age or race or whatever it might be, is so important, because we know that you know, for orthopedic surgeons, you're not just operating, you know, like, so there are a lot of male orthopedic surgeons, right? They're not only operating on males, they're operating on females as well. They're operating on people of all ages as well, and all experiences. So when we can have more diversity of thought and people from different backgrounds, that just helps to broaden that perspective of what the world needs and what our patients need as well. So I think that's super helpful. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, Shanae, but I know you'd mentioned like some of the care that your mom had gotten too, and some of the disparities she had encountered too. I don't know if you want to speak to that, but I know you were sharing that with me earlier, and just how that has been harmful for her and her experience. And yeah, that can happen sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. So listeners, if you tuned in to our last episode, you learned that I identify as a Black multiracial female. And in fact, I'm the fourth generation in my family. So both my parents identify as Black multiracial individuals, and so do their parents. So, you know, my family has come together with great racial mixing, dating back to my great grandparents. And knowing that my mom identifies as a woman of color, she did need two hip surgeries. And her first hip surgery, she did not have the best experience. She came out of surgery and her pain meds were not ordered. So she was in agonizing pain for some time until that order could be completed. And, you know, she also had a not so positive interaction with a nurse. So she had a surgical bandage after her surgery that needed to come off. And that nurse just wanted to rip it off all at once. And my mother was like, "Oh no, this is too painful. Can you use rubbing alcohol or anything else to help loosen the adhesive?" But she had to advocate for herself in those instances. And so just thinking about folks that may not feel as empowered to advocate for themselves and feels voiceless, what is the messages that we're sending when we're giving patients care? And we never want patients to walk away feeling like, "Hey, did I get treated this way because I'm a woman of color or because I am a woman?" And that's how she felt. And that's how she left that experience. And so when she needed her second hip surgery, she decided to go to a completely different hospital and a completely different doctor to receive better care. And so that's just one human level experience of how these things really do play out and why it's important for us to be aware of our implicit biases.
Thanks for sharing that. I think, I hope your mom got better care with the second surgeon. But I think that, you know, it just really highlights that I think a lot of people who don't have that lived experience can write it off and say, "Oh no, I'm sure it wasn't. It was just a one-time thing." But somebody who is in that skin for their whole life has had that happen more than one time, probably. And I think it's important to recognize that it can't just be written off, and you do have to really recognize the experiences that your patients go through. I think there's so much research on this, the difference of care, differences in maternal morbidity and mortality, and within the OBGYN world, looking at Black females as compared to white females during childbirth. It is a stark difference in terms of the really scary things that can happen after childbirth. And I'm sure, you know, it's researched really well in OBGYN. I'm sure it's not isolated to that field and probably deserving of more research elsewhere. So I think that's a super important thing to highlight as we care for patients and as we look for new residents or new faculty members who are also going to help join in that mission of taking appropriate care for patients. So thanks for sharing that, Shanae.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Now, the next topic I want to talk on is really pertaining to the surgeon selection idea and thinking about, as we're reviewing these applications, I've seen so much talk about coded language. So thinking about, in particular, when we're talking about gender, the different words that are used for female versus male applicants in letters of recommendation and things of that nature. So can you guys touch a little bit on what coded language is? And we could even, you know, we have time, delve into a little bit of what toxic masculinity is, what it looks like in the search and selection process.
Yeah, for sure. So, the idea of coded language, and Dr. Chambers, I'd love to hear if you've heard any of these examples. I'd love to hear, you know, since you've been on search and selection committees, I'd love to hear if you've heard some of these, you know, not to call anyone out, but you know, they're pretty common. I know I have been in interview committees and I've heard these terms before, but yeah, typically, you know, like words that we might use, and we think about coded language is kind of binary. You know, we have like male or masculine terms versus female or feminine terms. And for males, you might hear words like competitive, aggressive, decisive, courageous, fearless, right? And for females, you might hear collaborative, dependable, honest, interpersonal, enthusiastic, connected. So if you notice, even with those, there's sort of stereotypes that are really being brought into how male candidates might be discussed versus a female candidate. And of course, that just contributes to this whole idea of gender bias, right? And how that can come into play with how people who are on a search selection committee might talk about those candidates and then what decisions they might make based on that. You know, when you're describing a male versus female and using these different words, well, this one just sounds stronger, you know, and if we're adding a stronger word to a male, well, we're probably going to hire this male. And then we just perpetuate the cycle continues. So that's part of that.
Yeah. And to answer your question, I certainly have seen that. So I try to really be on the lookout for that as I'm reading through letters and as I'm writing letters myself, because even, you know, I am a female, but I'll catch myself like, oh, let's look for a better word. So, you know, this first came to my mind when I saw a Twitter post about it last kind of application season. And this post had this really useful resource. It was like a one page kind of list of like, instead of this word, use this word for your female candidates. And I even found this resource that has a gender bias calculator where you can paste in the text of your letter of recommendation and kind of look at how many of those coded language kind of words you have, which I found super interesting.
That's awesome. Love hearing that.
And then how about on the topic of toxic masculinity? I feel like this is kind of a catchphrase that we hear, you know, in social media and in regular media. And it's another thing that I think sounds so harsh that it can get kind of written off, but it's real. And I think it can make its way into our workplace and selection process. What would you guys, what would you say about how we need to look for that and address that within the search and selection process?
Yeah, definitely. I can chime in here. So yes, toxic masculinity or unhealthy masculinity is a term that has been gaining traction in the past few years. And this term is really just referring to the dominant form of masculinity, wherein men use dominance, violence, or control to assert their power. And so, you know, this may come off as telling younger boys to man up, or saying, oh, boys will be boys, to like write off a behavior. And so when we think about orthopedic surgery, and knowing that it is male dominant, this is something to for sure look out for, and to see like what is the workplace culture that's being expressed. And so some of those more extreme examples, it can be an environment of unconditional physical toughness, physical aggression, fear of emotions, not being able to bring your emotions to your work, you know, maybe having hyper independence, not being as collaborative, or even having views that are anti-feminism, and not including others that identify outside of our being heterosexual. So when we think of this on the search and selection committee and how this plays a role, again, knowing that there's mainly there's more men in this department, most likely the department chair or the chair of the search committee will be a male. And so thinking about that dynamic, and one thing to really pay attention to is groupthink bias. So if the selection committee chair is saying, I want this candidate for these reasons, and they're being pretty aggressive about it, and they're not really asking for other input of others on this search committee, folks may not feel like they have the psychological safety to speak up and to voice their opinion on candidates. And so we will fall victim to groupthink, where everyone is just saying, yep, let's just agree with the chair and we'll just move this candidate forward. So that is an area that you definitely should think about in one way that toxic masculinity may show up in the workplace culture.
Well, thank you all so much. I think we got some really good pearls to take from this as we head into our residency and fellowship interview season. So I really appreciate you spending the time with us to talk through this and sharing your expertise. So thanks everybody for tuning in to the Implicit Bias podcast and learning a bit more about how to address the gender biases present in our male-dominated field. Currently, only 7.4% of practicing orthopedic surgeons in the U.S. are female in 2022. So thank you to Matt and Shania for some tips on making it maybe a more equitable road to orthopedics for our future candidates. Thanks.
We'll keep trying. Yeah, thank you, Dr. Chambers.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been a partnership between the University of Minnesota Medical School, Department of Orthopedic Surgery, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, and the Medical School Office of DEI. Thank you for listening.